All right, today's show, October 15th, 2008. My commentary for today is going to be brief. Rabble-rousing shows are now archived and can be heard at your convenience 24/7. Tell your friends to go to the KVMR homepage, then in the right-hand column, click on Program Schedule, then click on Program Page for Rabble-rousing. Past shows will be listed there. Sometimes it takes a week to post a show, sometimes it goes up quicker. That's what happens when we're all volunteers. Please be patient. They'll soon be up. For all you history buffs, Washington Monthly has uncovered an interesting election year factoid. The McCain-Palin ticket is the first in American history in which both candidates were found to have violated ethics standards before a national election. McCain, of course, was admonished by Senate Ethics Committee for, quote, exercising poor judgment, for intervening with federal regulators on behalf of Charles Keating as part of the infamous Keating 5 scandal. And now McCain's running mate has also been found to have violated state ethic laws and abused the powers of her office as part of the Troopergate scandal. This nation has had 102 major party tickets covering 51 presidential elections over more than two centuries, and we've never had a ticket in which both candidates on the same ticket were responsible for ethics violations before a national election. McCain Palin is the first. Yes, folks, they really are mavericks. Next item. Are all of you out there growing tired of my focusing on the election and the economy? I am. But what else is more important? This too shall pass. Here we go again. Election deja vu all over again. This is by Michael McCoy, writing in opednews.com. All the world is but a stage, and all of the men and women merely players. Willie Shakespeare. The four-year cycle is upon us again, a necessary stage act. The critical and nationwide ruse commonly referred to as an election, a selection process necessary to maintain the all-important illusion that we, the commoners, have a voice in our governance. Once again, Americans in massive numbers rally around and pay homage to their favorite presidential candidate. One of the two that have been presented as our choice, one of which will lead us to higher places, a better life, a promising future for our children, the person that will pose as the human symbol of our nation, the other, undoubtedly, a villain in disguise that will bring certain ruin to us all. But our choices, our choosing, our preferences have nothing to do with it. First, in a carefully created process designed by our powers that be to ensure their absolute control, a hodgepodge of state primary selection processes, best understood by those that hide behind the curtain, is carefully manipulated with the utmost of skill but determination as the illusion begins. As the process progresses, state by state, the contenders for the highest office in the land are carefully maneuvered into place by cabals of self-serving, secretive people that rule from behind the curtain. These are self-appointed and moneyed interests. They are our true masters, and they hold the real levers of power. Could it be coincidence that most U.S. presidents descend from British royalty and or were confirmed Masons? The caste system is alive and well in America. It has been from the very beginning. No, little Bobby, not everyone can grow up to be the president. During the campaign, each candidate spouts carefully rehearsed and lofty phrases, slogans best suited for bumper stickers that are refined daily, espousing ideals and inspiration designed to invoke pride and patriotism that will in practice be meaningless after the selection is announced. The age-old effective tradition of mudslinging and personal attacks intensifies as the big day approaches. Critical issues devolve into simplistic soundbites. Debates are analyzed, reanalyzed, critiqued, and assessed. Substance is always discarded for fascinations with body language or slips of the tongue. Is he wearing his Support Our Troops lapel pin? All important aspects of the grand charade. Americans love a horse race. Meanwhile, an army of vote manipulators fan out in all directions to lay their groundwork and shape the outcome before the voting even begins. The pre-vote is being massaged at this very moment. The fraudster co-conspirators will further shape the vote count afterwards in darkened rooms and through the use of magical software. Diebold and ESNS, whose machines will account for 80% of the votes in the 2008 election, are owned by brothers. They plan a celebration. Again. There is no federal agency with regulatory authority or oversight of the U.S. voting machine industry. None. As the big day approaches, the commentators, the pundits, the talking heads, and the experts revel in the intrigue. America will be fixed to their screens in anticipation. The insiders and the networks will all rejoice in the grand deception. Viewership and profits soar. Corporate advertisers will be pleased. Backslapping will be widespread. The media propaganda hawkers will have pleased its masters in the all-important management of the public. Again, careers will be advanced, most notably those of the cooperative and the high profile, those that best understand the nod and wink, the secret handshake. Editors, managers, and directors of the grand stage will be free of a litany of subtle yet damaging official reprisals. News media owners will have furthered the grand agenda, the elaborate hoax disguised as a contest. All will be well within the institutions of professional deception and public psychology. The most elaborate sleight of hand, the epitome of conspiracies, with the grandest of results carried on in perpetuity, the control and steering of the great ship America and its inattentive occupants and owners. And on the morning of November 5th, the whiners and malcontents alleging vote fraud will immediately be marginalized by our media overseers. The grand prize winner will be officially announced, and our faceless masters will have pulled it off again. And small groups of special interests will have their way with America again. It's we, the commoners, in massive numbers that will be oblivious to what has actually happened while legitimacy is proclaimed by our media overseers. That's the way legitimacy is created. It's the way consent is manufactured, the way the so-called bewildered herd is managed. The results are profound. Higher stakes are not to be found anywhere on the planet. And finally, on January 20th, with the centerpiece of the grandest of ruses in human history having gone swimmingly, again, the winning candidate, long ago predetermined by our overlords, takes the oath of office as the President of the United States, while Americans in vast numbers, many winners, many losers, but all managed, settle in for the four-year reality that has been created for them again. The author is Michael McCoy, and he has this to say about himself. He's a free American, Vietnam-era vet, and he's ensured that he can withstand an IRS audit and any sudden unannounced search of his home and documents in his absence or otherwise. He obsesses about nothing but abscesses over the perversion of his country's ideals, values, and democratic due process by cleverly disguised dictators. He has a passion to see the real mass murderers of 9/11 exposed, with all due disgrace, and each conspirator liar that sought the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent institutionalized murder held accountable on the world stage. Quote, I love my country, yet I fear my government, and if you don't, you're not paying attention. Close quote. That was a man named Michael McCoy. Okay, having said that, I'll give you one article on Sarah Palin and one on Obama. A loyal listener sent this in with her comment. This is from The Guardian. Sadly, it seems to take a Brit to say these things. This is Michelle Goldberg writing in The Guardian out of London. It's titled, Flirting Her Way to Victory. Sarah Palin's farcical debate performance lowered the standards for both female candidates and U.S. political discourse. At least three times last night, Sarah Palin, the adorable, preposterous vice presidential candidate, winked at the audience. Had a male candidate with a similar reputation for attractive vapidity made such a brazen attempt to flirt his way into the good graces of the voting public, it would have been universally noted, discussed, and mocked. Palin, however, has single-handedly so lowered the standard, both for female candidates and American political discourse, that with her newfound ability to speak in more or less full sentences, she is now deemed to have performed acceptably last night. By any normal standard, including the ones applied to male presidential candidates of either party, she did not. Early on, she made the astonishing announcement that she had no intentions of actually answering the queries put to her. Quote, I may not answer the questions that either the moderator or you want to hear, but I'm going to talk straight to the American people and let them know my track record also, she said. And so she proceeded with an almost surreal disregard for the subject she was supposed to be discussing, to unleash fusillades of scripted attack lines, platitudes, lies, gibberish, and grating references to her own pseudo-folksy authenticity. It was an appalling display. The only reason it was not widely described as such is that too many American pundits don't even try to judge the truth, wisdom, or reasonableness of the political rhetoric they're paid to pronounce upon. Instead, they imagine themselves as interpreters of a mythical mass of average Americans who they both venerate and despise. In pronouncing upon a debate, they don't try and determine whether a candidate's responses correspond to existing reality, or whether he or she is capable of talking about subjects such as the deregulation of the financial markets or the devolution of the war in Afghanistan. The criteria are far more vaporous. In this case, it was whether Palin could avoid utterly humiliating herself for 90 minutes, and whether urbane commentators would believe that she had connected to a public that they see as ignorant and sentimental. For the Alaska governor, mission accomplished. There is indeed something mesmerizing about Palin, with her maniac beaming and fulsome confidence in her own charm. The force of her personality managed to slightly obscure the insulting emptiness of her answers last night. It's worth reading the transcript of the encounter, where it becomes clear how bizarre much of what she said was. Here, for example, is how she responded to Biden's comments about how the middle class has been shortchanged during the Bush administration and how McCain will continue Bush policies. "Say it ain't so, Joe. There you go again, pointing backward again. You preferenced your whole comment with the Bush administration. Now, doggone it, let's look ahead and tell Americans what we have to plan to do for them in the future. You mentioned education, and I'm glad you did. I know education you were passionate about with your wife being a teacher for 30 years, and God bless her. Her reward is in heaven, right? My brother, who I think is the best school teacher in the year, and here's a shout-out to all those third graders at Gladys Wood Elementary School. You get extra credit for watching the debate." That was a direct quote of Sarah Palin during the debate. Evidently, Palin's pre-debate handlers judged her incapable of speaking on a fairly wide range of subjects, and so instructed her to simply disregard questions that did not invite memorized talking points or cutesy filibustering. They probably told her to play up her spunky averageness, which she did to the point of shtick and dishonesty. Asked what her Achilles heel is, a question she either didn't understand or chose to ignore, she started in on how McCain chose her because of her connection to the heartland of America. Being a mom, one very concerned about a son in the war, about a special needs child, about kids heading off to college. How are we going to pay those tuition bills? None of Palin's children, it should be noted, is heading off to college. Her son is on his way to Iraq, and her pregnant 17-year-old daughter is engaged to be married to a high school dropout and self-described blankety-blank redneck. Palin is a woman who can't even tell the truth about the most quotient and public details of her own life, never mind about matters of major public import. In her only vice presidential debate, she was shallow, mendacious, and phony. What kind of maverick, after all, keeps harping on what a maverick she is? That her performance was considered anything but a farce does not show how high Palin has risen, but how low the rest of us have sunk. This was a British writer, a woman writer, Michelle Goldberg, writing in The Guardian out of London. Would that we would have American journalists with the courage to write that sort of thing. Next one, about Obama. "I've been receiving quite a few..." This is not me speaking. This is the writer, Stephen Pizzo. "I've been receiving quite a few..." No, I'm sorry, it is me. "I've been receiving quite a few emails listing all sorts of negative things about Barack Obama. Listeners sent them to me for my comment." Well, here it is. This is by Stephen Pizzo, writing in Smirking Chimp, and he calls it "Revealed, the Right Minister of Information." Okay, this is Pizzo talking. "I get a lot of emails from right-wingers trying to straighten me out on the facts. You know the facts, like that Obama's a terrorist and he's a Muslim and that he's not even an American citizen. The other day, one of these characters challenged me, right-winger. 'Steve, you know Obama wasn't even born in the United States.' 'Yes, he was. He was born in Hawaii. Then why can't anyone find his birth certificate? Nonsense. If that were true, reporters would have been all over it like stink. I'll bet you a dollar you can't find a birth certificate for Obama in Hawaii. So I went online and in less than 2 minutes found the damn thing, copied it and emailed it back to him with a note. Okay, you owe me a buck. And you believe that's real? It's fake. Further proof, you can lead a jackass to the well of truth, but you can't force him to drink. So many of the knocks on Obama from the writers so outrageous, so transparently false that I've wondered, are the people who embrace the claims as gospel mentally ill, or is there anything really behind all these charges? Well, I'll give the believers the benefit of doubt and just classify them as misinformed. But the right's misinformation in chief is crazy, and that's not me saying so. Quote, Andy Martin is a law school graduate, but his admission to the Illinois bar was blocked in the 70s after a psychiatrist's finding of, quote, moderately severe character defect manifested by well-documented ideation with a paranoid flavor and a grandiose character. And the writer even includes the document there. That little nugget comes from a New York Times profile on Andy Martin published today. Of course, since the story appears in Satan's very own liberal media outlet, many right-wingers will simply dismiss this story out of hand. Here's the story. The man behind the whispers about Obama, the author is Jim Rutenberg, and he's writing in the New York Times. The most persistent falsehood about Senator Barack Obama's background first hit in 2004, just 2 weeks after the Democratic convention speech that helped him set him on the path to his presidential candidacy. Quote, Obama is a Muslim who has concealed his religion, close quote. Until this month, the man who is widely credited with starting the Cyber Whisper campaign that still dogs Mr. Obama was a secondary character in news reports, with deep explorations of his background largely confined to liberal blogs. But an appearance in a documentary-style program on the Fox News Channel, watched by 3 million people last week, thrust the man, Andy Martin, and his past into the foreground. The program allowed Mr. Martin to assert falsely and without challenge that Mr. Obama had once trained to overthrow the government. Amongst the story's other revelations, an examination of legal documents and election filings along with interviews with his acquaintance revealed Mr. Martin's website, freerepublic.com, is the source of a constant flow of scintillating, while often untrue, claims. In 1993, Martin was featured on the CBS News program 48 Hours, which devoted an hour-long program to Martin's prolific filings of frivolous lawsuits. He's filed so many lawsuits that a judge barred him from doing so in any federal court without preliminary approval. He prepared to run for Congress in Connecticut, where paperwork for one of his campaign committees listed as one purpose of his run as to exterminate Jew power. While running for president in 1999, he aired a television advertisement in New Hampshire that accused George W. Bush of using cocaine. In the 1990s, Mr. Martin was jailed in a case in Florida involving a physical altercation. Over the years, he's left a trail of acrimony, political opponents, lawyers, and judges, with his anti-Jewish Semitic comments. Court papers support claims that Martin is often an openly impugned Jew. A motion he filed in a 1983 bankruptcy case called the judge a crooked, slimy Jew who has a history of lying and thieving common to members of his race. In another motion filed in 83, Mr. Martin wrote, I'm able to understand how the Holocaust took place and with every passing day feel less and less sorry that it did. When asked Friday about an assertion in his court papers that, quote, Jews historically and in daily living act through clans and in wolf pack syndrome, he said, that sort of thing rings a bell. He said he was not anti-Semitic. I was trying to show that everybody in the bankruptcy court was Jewish and I was not Jewish, he said, and I was being victimized by religious bias. So, mystery solved. Those crazy allegations about Obama's heritage, religion, and citizenship are crazy. They're cooked up by a guy who, in the kindest terms, suffers from a severe personality disorder. His outrageous and often untrue charges are then believed by those out there that demographers and pollers now discreetly refer to as low-information voters. What he's generating gets picked up in other places, said Daniel Allen, a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, who was investigating the email campaign's circulation and origins. And it's an example of how the Internet has given power to sources we would have never taken seriously at another point in time. So if you're related to any of these low-information voters, and aren't we all, send them the link to this story so at least they can no longer claim the liberal media is hiding the true facts about Obama from voters. The liberal media likes a good scoop as much as Fox News and the Washington Times. So if Obama were actually guilty of any one of these charges that flow from Andy Martin's moderately severe character defect, i.e. imagination, it would be the biggest scoop of the campaign. I don't know, and even the most liberal journalist who wouldn't want that scoop for himself or herself. Hell, I'd even come out of retirement for a crack at that one. So, for those of you that have been receiving emails claiming that a whole list of scurrious things about Obama, they seem to originate from this one man, Andy Martin, and his website. The time, 12:30 in the p.m., the place, Nevada City, the radio station, KVMR, broadcasting out of Nevada City. The host is Chamba Lane, and the name of the show is Rabble Rousing. And we have a caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
I have indeed received those sort of emails from some of my right-wing friends.
Yes.
And what is the link to this article that you just wrote, or just read?
Okay. Stephen Pizzo, P-I-Z-Z-O, he was writing in smirkingchimp.com, and evidently it's from a New York Times article, The Man Behind the Whispers About Obama, Jim Rutenberg, R-U-T-E-N-B-E-R-G, and I don't have the date for that New York Times article.
But the story that you just read came from Smirking Chimp?
Yes, smirkingchimp.com.
Okay, great.
Author Stephen Pizzo, P-I-Z-Z-O.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Bye.
On with the show. Is it possible that a leading newspaper in Belize can put its journalistic finger on what you and I are perhaps not allowed to see on good old TV? The awareness of this article may deeply disturb the fragile condition of your present status quo. It seems you must go offshore if you want to know the facts as they are not being covered in the American media. This is from Amandala, which is Belize's leading newspaper. This refers to a brief article I read last week, or a brief mention I made last week, that the country of Iceland declared bankruptcy. And I made some sort of a facetious comment about that. Well, now here's the rest of the story. And it's from Amandala, the leading newspaper in Belize, the country of Belize. The Prime Minister of Iceland, Geir Haarde, sent shivers through the global financial system when he asserted that Iceland cannot and will not pay the foreign liabilities of its banking sector, and that the interests of Iceland will have first priority. Yesterday, Haarde told a press conference, quote, "The point is this. The total indebtedness is such that there's no way that the Icelandic population can take responsibility for the debt that these private companies have incurred. It happens every day in bankruptcies that some are burnt." Close quote. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown called Iceland's behavior totally unacceptable and warned of legal action to recover the $174 billion losses in Iceland, especially after the Icelandic government this week passed emergency legislation to deal with a banking collapse. Unlike the British or U.S. plans, this was not a bank rescue plan, but legislation that gave the government the authority to seize any bank or financial company, put it through a bankruptcy or other procedure that would put the interests of the Icelandic nation over that of its banks. Let me interrupt to please compare that with the bailout in the United States, which did nothing to help the people and was all for the banks. Back to the article. Next door to us, Mexico's peso lost 24% of its value against the dollar, making its imports of wheat, corn, beans, milk, and rice 24% more expensive. The Peasant Association reported yesterday that remittance for the month of September fell 29%, causing panic in Mexico. Remittances from the U.S. are Mexico's second leading source of foreign exchange. These are remittances by Mexicans that have come up here to work and are sending money back to their families. That fell by 29% last month. On the other side of the world, the financial meltdown that started on Wall Street is now hurting farmers in Siberia, threatening a Russian agricultural revival that the United Nations says is needed to help avert a world food shortage. Cash-strapped Russian banks have cut funding to a sector already reeling from plummeting grain prices and soaring borrowing costs. The collapse of the Russian stock market has closed off the other main money source for Russian agricultural companies, which produce 9% of the world's wheat. The speculators are not fools. The efforts of U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and his plunge protection team are being overwhelmed as the largest volume of financial bets in world history crushes their bailoff efforts, which are unprecedented in scope, but are nonetheless puny in comparison to the tumor they're trying to save. Driving all of this is the global casino known as the derivative markets, a market which dwarfs the world's mortgage, bond, and stock markets combined. While mortgages, stocks, and bonds are measured in the trillions of dollars, the derivatives market is measured in quadrillions, or a thousand of trillions of dollars. Today, the Derivative Association said that the size of the over-the-counter market is about $675 trillion. Putting a number to the size of the derivatives market is virtually impossible, but putting a number to the value of the derivatives market is easy. Zero. Derivatives were the great financial innovation of the Greenspan era, in which casino-style bets on the price movements of currencies, bonds, and stocks replaced the ownership of those items as a way to make money. The bets thus placed soon far outstripped the levels of the market upon which they were nominally based, as derivatives became the prime source of, quote, profit for the financial markets. That these profits were entirely fictitious, a fancy form of casino floor betting chips, securitization, was considered irrelevant as long as the market was growing and the funny money was pouring in. Last year, August, however, the global financial system died, sealing the doom of the derivatives game. Today, the collapse of the derivatives market is crushing the international financial system as the speculators fight to save their fictitious profits through the largest bailout attempt in history. According to the most recent data for June 30th this year, released today by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the three largest American banking holding companies, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citicorp, had current outstanding derivatives contracts totaling $179 trillion. The three banks combined have total assets of just under $6.5 trillion. Now do you see why the bailout is not working? And cannot work? There isn't enough money in the world to cover all of these virtual bets. And the efforts by the central banks to print that money is fueling a hyperinflationary bomb which will wipe out not only the remnants of the global financial system, but also the governments, national economies, and the means of existence for most of the world's population. Hyperinflation will destroy the value of the U.S. dollar itself, wiping out pensions, savings, bank accounts, stock portfolios, and all other monetary values, bankrupting households, businesses, and governments, leaving all the nation-states destroyed and effectively no longer nation-states. It is essential that the bailout of the derivative bubble be stopped immediately. All derivative trades should be declared null and void and wiped off the books of the speculators. Any financial instrument containing a derivative should also be declared null and void and wiped off the books. This unregulated, insanely leveraged casino should be shut down and all claims arising from derivative bets nullified, as Iceland has done. If you want to research this article, go to www.amandala.com/BZ, which is Belize. Interesting perspective. I don't pretend to understand economics. I don't mess with it. But the article rings true to me. Okay, this one's called An Omero for Your Thought by Robert Singer, writing in opednews.com. The dollar has been poised to collapse since 1980. Turns out Iraq had no nuclear weapons, but by rejecting the dollar in favor of the euro, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela now, excuse me, this doesn't make sense. The dollar has been poised to collapse since 1980. Turns out Iraq had no nuclear weapons, but, and he's trying to make the point that we invaded Iraq and took out Saddam because Saddam was about to start trading oil in euros rather than dollars. That's conveniently forgotten. Okay, he goes on to say, by rejecting the dollar in favor of the euro, Iran, North Korea, and Venezuela now have weapons of financial mass destruction to use against the U.S. By converting most of their currency reserves to euros, they threaten our ability to export our debt. So we're hearing it's time to go in a new direction. What new direction? Probably the North American Union or some other hyperinflationary scheme. The North American Union, NAU, is the formation of a supranational organization modeled on the European Union, and it will fuse Canada, United States, and Mexico into a single economic and political unit. Dollars and pesos will be phased out and replaced with a common North American currency called the Amero. How will they get away with this? We'll demand it. And it won't be the first time public outcry resulted in the monetary system being stabilized. After the panic of 1907, President Theodore Roosevelt signed into law the bill creating the National Monetary Commission. Americans will welcome the NAU and the AMRO because they're being conditioned to believe their voices do matter. They will think it was their idea and that it was a just idea. Robert H. Hemphill, credit manager, Atlanta Fed, writes, we are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. Let me do that again. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we're prosperous. If not, we starve. We're absolutely without a permanent monetary system. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position is almost incredible, but there it is. It is so important that our present civilization may collapse unless it becomes widely understood and the defects remedied soon. This was the credit manager of the Atlanta Fed. The problem with modern money is that it does not constitute a store of value. The only two assets that are money and cannot fail during a credit crisis are silver and gold. All fiat currencies eventually collapse because they do not constitute a store of value. A fiat currency is a currency that is declared to be currency with nothing of value behind it. Behind every consumer society is the reality of a credit-based monetary system. Behind every foreclosure and American dream, there's a fiat currency. Ted Butler, a brilliant researcher who recognized early on that silver is both a precious metal and an industrial commodity, has been writing about the manipulation of the price of silver for years and waiting for the day when silver will skyrocket. He writes, few know that as a result of a structural deficit that lasted for more than 60 years, world silver inventories have been depleted to levels 90% less than what existed a mere 65 years ago. Few know that, as a result of this depletion caused by industrial consumption, there is actually less investment silver in the world than there is gold, even though gold is more than 50 times the price of silver. Few know that silver has the largest concentrated short position in financial history. Silver is manipulated by the largest short position in history, but when Butler is asked if the manipulated downward price is consistent with a strategy to encourage the purchase of silver, he finds it difficult to explain a greed and profit motivation and instead reiterates, my main motive has been and still remains doing what I can to end this manipulative crime and process. Ted Butler is apparently not familiar with Ney's first law of financial markets. Richard Ney wrote two best-selling books published in 1973, Making It in the Market and The Wall Street Jungle. Ney's Law. A stock, or in this case gold and silver, will do not move up or down in price because you buy or sell. You buy or sell because the price of gold or you buy or sell because the price of gold or silver moves up or down. In other words, greed motivates people to buy on the euphoria of the price of gold and silver rising, and panic causes them to sell. In the case of silver, the low price discourages an investment in silver. What Butler and the rest of the consumers do not understand is that without our fiat currency and the puppet masters manipulating the paper price of silver and gold to keep us from buying, our consumer society and the Federal Reserve would never have gotten off Jekyll Island in 1910. An Admiral for Your Thoughts by Robert Singer, writing in opednews.com. Next one called Lies, Damn Lies, and Polls. It's by David Swanson, writing in Smirking Chimp. David W. Moore, who worked for Gallup for 13 years as managing editor and senior editor of the Gallup Poll, has a new book out denouncing most polls by Gallup or anyone else is useless, and explaining that this became obvious to him when he first began working at Gallup, which raises the obvious question of why he stuck around for 13 years. The explanation seems to be that he was trying to fix the problem, and one of the motivations for the book seems to be that he believes he still can fix it. Of all the endless multi-layered criticism I have of polls, this is David Swanson speaking, of all the endless multi-layered criticisms I have of polls, Moore focuses obsessively on only one. In a 160-page book on such a huge topic, you could expect more than one idea endlessly repeated, but you won't find any more than that in the opinion makers. An insider exposes the truth behind the polls. Moore's concern is a significant one. He objects to the fact that polls are conducted and reported as if ignorance and apathy do not exist. Moore shows that when pollsters ask people whether they know about a topic, or whether they care if Congress acts in accordance with their wishes, the results turn out very differently from the ordinary poll that simply asks for a policy position. With a method that acknowledges indecision, you can end up with a huge percentage of Americans having no opinion or not really caring. If you poll in this way, you discover, for example, that a majority of Americans did not want the invasion of Iraq. A majority of Americans simply tolerated it. Moore thinks polling is done quickly and shoddily to suit the interests of media outlets. I think it is also done in many ways to suit the policy agenda of media corporations. Moore makes no mention of the single biggest problem with pollsters, namely that they do not poll at all on topics that are not approved by their media corporations. Let's examine the history of polling on the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. The Lewis Harper Polling Company was amongst the companies that poll for money, but they refused to poll on this topic, even if they were paid. While the few pollsters that did poll found high support, others declared that they, quote, would not poll on something that was not in the news. But of course, media outlets poll on things all the time, precisely in order to report on the polls and create news. It's hard to say which is a bigger problem, the way polls are conducted or the way the results are reported. Moore discusses the shortcomings of various polls on the topic of defense cuts, completely oblivious to the fact that he's consistently labeling military cuts as defense cuts, something they're not, and something few people would be eager to support. Point being, if you poll people on defense cuts, they would certainly not, we need defense. But if you polled them and called it military cuts, you'd get a different result. Back to the article. He discusses polling and what the Democrats and what the Republicans have done in Congress, never noticing that these polls are thereby asking citizens about the actions of parties rather than the actions of their elected representatives. Moore does give many examples of how polls are misleadingly worded, generating results of very little worth. Moore also gives examples of Gallup and others misleading reporting on their results. Here's an example that I'll contribute. In 2006, Newsweek reported the shocking news that a majority of Americans favored impeaching the president. But read how Newsweek reported this. Other parts of a potential Democratic agenda received less support, especially calls to impeach Bush. 47% of Democrats say that would be a top priority, but only 28% of all Americans say it should be. 23% said it should be a lower priority, and nearly half, 44%, said it should not be done. Excuse me for interrupting, but in case you missed it, over half of those polls were in favor of impeachment, although you might have missed that by the way it was reported. Back to the story. And then there's the use of polls to reflect bad reporting. As Moore notes, when media outlets report something over and over again, they're almost always able to then poll on it and discover that a lot of the public agrees with what they've been hearing. My comment, I believe that technique was a favorite of a guy named Hermann Goebbels, the chief Nazi propagandist. What he said was, if you tell a lie often enough, people end up seeing it as truth. Back to the article. Moore suggests that media outlets and polling companies should not be allowed to be one and the same, that media outlets might report more honestly on all polls if their aim wasn't to promote their own polls, and that polling companies might poll better if not purely trying to please media outlets. Moore devotes a lot of space to criticizing electoral polling, including early and pointless primary polling, and he suggests that only polling immediately before an election or exit polling can predict an outcome. Yet Moore steers clear of admitting exactly how extremely accurate such polling tends to be, and when it conflicts, even shockingly, with official results. This pollster joins the rest of them in happily tossing his profession in the trash in order to accept official poll counts. What light does Moore's analysis shed on current presidential polls? I don't know to what extent Moore would agree with my impression that many of the current presidential polls are slated in favor of Republicans by polling equal numbers of Republicans and Democrats, even though there are many more Democrats in the country, and by not polling new voters or cell phone users. But I'm pretty sure Moore would agree with criticisms of how the media is reporting on those polls. As Daily Kos and other bloggers point out on Sunday, the Washington Post is labeling any state in which McCain is ahead by even 2% as leaning Republican, but states Obama is ahead of by 14% as battlegrounds. Many pollsters are currently forecasting a decisive Electoral College victory for Obama, but the big corporate media outlets are not making such predictions. If the polling were better and the reporting on it better, election theft would be far more difficult. If the polling and policy positions were better done and reported in the agenda for the next government in Washington would come more in line with the desire of Americans. So by all means, let's fix polling and make it work for us, not for Rupert Murdoch. David Swanson, writing and Smirking Chimp. Okay, I'm going to try and get through a long one because I think I like the guy's style. There's a blog by Tom Engelhart. In the last year, the Bush administration's top officials have sunk much of their increasingly lame duck energy into pacifying Iraq, and so getting it out to the news and the spotlight at least long enough for election 2008 to happen, and undoubtedly long enough as well for them to get out of town in January. And then what happens? The administration was ambushed, not by Sunni militia, militants, or Shiite radicals, but by its own people, investment bankers, lenders, hedge fund managers, financial management types, the very people for whom they organized the world and who had long been paying fast and loose and profitably with our economic system. The ambush, of course, took the form of financial meltdown of massive proportions, for which, as in Iraq in 2003, the administration had clearly done no significant pre-planning or wargaming. And, as with the insurgency then, so now they operated by the increasingly worn and seat of their pants. Their attempted $7 billion purge, as stock exchanges around the world indicated yesterday, wasn't likely to pacify a global financial system. Here's a sure thing: George W. Bush and Dick Cheney won't make it out of town in time. Their wars will remain disasters, their imperial dreams so much smoke, and domestically they may have created the condition for a turning point election that could bring to Washington not only a resurgent Democratic Party, but the first black president of the United States. Quite a record for our commander-in-chief. Chalmers Johnson, whose latest book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, warned of a possibility of a profligate, militarized U.S. going bankrupt, considers whether in the ruins of Bush's financial Katrina, an Obama victory and a reconfiguring election are possible, or whether deep-seated racism and embedded regional party loyalties will prove too much even for this catastrophic moment. I don't think I'm going to have time to get through this, so I'm going to save the actual article by Chalmers Johnson for next week. Next week, I think so. Okay. Do we have time for this one? Yeah. 2008 election results to be routed in private to private middlemen in Illinois, Colorado, and Illinois. This is in Kentucky. This is by Bev Harris of Black Box Voting, published in opednews.com. A new Op-Ed News article details information about the pending subpoena of Mike Connell in connection with a transfer of the Ohio election results server to a partisan server in 2004. Black Box Voting has learned that similar results middlemen are already being set up in 2008 for Illinois, Colorado, and Kentucky. At this point, citizens to get out on a search and expose mission for every state to learn the routing of election results, production, and publication. So a point they're making, and we'll make in this article, that it's not how you vote, it's who counts the votes. Thank you, Joe Stalin, for that one. Corroboration of the inappropriate Ohio connection. First, more on the Ohio subpoenas that is the subject of the article linked above. That article deals with allegations that an inappropriate middleman presence in the routing of 2004 Ohio election results. It does not prove evidence of tampering, as headlines claim. The critical kernel in these stories is that Ohio election results in 2004 appeared to have been routed to a partisan middleman operation before publication. A screenshot on E Pluribus Media shows that the Ohio election site was oddly transferred to SmartTech, hosting shortly before the 2004 election, then transferred back to the state of Ohio. Even more damning, the election results were again temporarily transferred to the SmartTech server shortly before the 2006 primary, then transferred back again afterwards. I've not been able to corroborate the source data for the screen grab at E Pluribus Media. The screen grab looks authentic. If authentic, grab your britches for the wild ride, because the subpoena will be fascinating. The extreme partisanship and inappropriateness of SmartTech as a server for anything to do with government elections is easy to collaborate. By paying a couple hundred bucks at Whois, you'll see that SmartTech site hosts dozens of sites that could not be more partisan. Numerous sites for the Republican National Committee, many anti-Obama propaganda sites, but no anti-McCain sites, and no Democratic sites. Republican candidates' domains, over a dozen sites from various domains owned by Prosperity for America, a partisan think tank that traces back principles from an enormous privately held oil company, Koch Industries. Perhaps more concerning, SmartTech also hosts the Voter Vault sites. Voter Vault is the powerful data mining Republican database, which can tell you what kind of syrup you like on your French toast, who you vote for, every address you've ever lived, and which magazines are your favorite. Black Box Voting has obtained corporate documents showing that Voter Vault was set up by Bruce Boreham, a political operative who got into hot water in Washington State for deceptive political activities. The Spoonamore affidavit referenced in the Ohio lawsuits deals only with theoretical issues. It should not be characterized as evidence of anything in particular occurred. It describes one man's concept of what could potentially occur. Okay, I'm going to skip over here. In Illinois, the Illinois middleman is connected with a partisan evangelical Baptist named David DeVost, who owns Robeson Company, a firm that sells an electronic handheld device. You know, I'm going to skip through this. The main point that she's trying to make, Bev Harris of Black Box Voting has been following election fraud for many years. She's making the point that in Illinois, in Kentucky, and in Colorado, there are shenanigans already going on with where the vote counts are transferred to. In other words, if you're going to steal an election, it's really hard to do it right at the ballot box. It's hard to do it election machines. It's much easier to do in the counting process, and she's saying this going on in those three states. Every citizen needs to take initiative to protect the count. Actions which count vary according to the counting system used in your location. Please get ready for action and stay tuned. So that's what she's saying. Okay, we're out of time. I'm going to give you the. I'm going to end with the post-turtle thing that I tried to do last week. A doctor struck up a conversation with an old rancher. Eventually, the topic got around to Sarah Palin and her bid to be a heartbeat away from being president. The old rancher said, "Well, you know, Palin is a post-turtle." Not being familiar with the term, the doctor asked what a post-turtle was. The old rancher said, "When you're driving down a country road and you come across a fence post with a turtle balanced on top, that's a post-turtle." The old rancher saw a puzzled look on the doctor's face, so he continued to explain. "You know, she didn't get up there by herself. She doesn't belong up there. She doesn't know what to do while she is up there, and you just wonder what kind of dumbass put her up there to begin with."